And you are tuned to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and streaming online at WPKN.org. Stay tuned for the Organic Farm Stand coming right up.
Corn in the fields, and listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. King harvest is surely come. I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down that day. Looks like this time I'm gonna get to stay. I'm a union man now all the way.
The smell of the leaves from the magnolia trees in the meadow. Harvest is surely come.
A dry summer, then come fall, which I depend on most of all.
All right, welcome to the Organic Farm Stand. It is June 1st, and we come to you the first and third Thursday of each month. Here we are, right on the cusp of, I would say, cruising blissfully toward the summer solstice. My name is Richard Hill. We have a very interesting show today, but we also have a full panel here, and that's great news because last show we were a bit challenged with phone problems. We had a sort of a dress rehearsal for the very interesting interview that we're going to have this week. But let's introduce the panel. To my left is Chris Ferriero, who is very kind to have joined us today. Thank you, Chris.
Hey, Richard.
Great to see you. Bill Dusing, dead center. Bill,
nice to be here.
Great to have you back with us. And Guy Beardsley to my right.
I know you can't see me because of the console, but that's okay, Richard. I'm there.
Yeah,
yes, I am here.
I feel you. And Guy came in today bearing the gifts for the gods. And I just want to tell you that the key to happiness, universal bliss, and peace on earth is a strawberry scone, still warm from the oven, gluten-free and organic.
Vegan.
Vegan?
Vegan too, yes.
And vegan, gluten-free, and organic.
And
completely.
Organic.
Right.
Alternating bites with fresh-picked strawberries. These are the first harvested from the Eco Garden in the White Hills of Shelton from Guy Beardsley. Guy, thank you so much.
You're more than welcome, right? We got to say, Bill, you were missed last week, something terrible. So we are always really glad to see you here. Absolutely.
That is a fact.
I was listening, though, on the beach in Rhode Island.
The beach, no less, right?
Yeah, you heard us spinning our wheels.
So, Guy, actually, I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Vegan and gluten-free, what do you use instead of eggs?
Flax. There's if you Google on the look at the internet, there's a vegan substitute for eggs. You make them out of flax.
And okay, yeah, because flax is pretty, has a lot of...
they're kind of viscous.
Yep.
It's a little bit when you...
Yeah.
I didn't even have to answer that. Bill, thank
well,
you very much.
I'd asked, or Becky was telling me as she passed in the scones, how she'd made it. And she uses some, the butter substitute. There's a lot of butters that aren't made out, margarine kind of things that are vegan.
But are not
made out of oil. No cow's milk involved, but
and
they
no plastic,
look like butter. Yeah.
No plastic.
Yeah.
which a lot of margarines used to have.
Like, yeah.
Real garbage. I'll tell you what. Let me just give you a heads up on what we're going to be doing today at 12:15 when we have the guests that were supposed to be here last show are going to try one more time, and our phones seem to be working today, so hopefully that will happen. We're going to be speaking with the executive director of MassNOFA, that is Julie Rawson, and her partner, who is the soil carbon program coordinator at, I believe, MassNOFA, Jack Kitteridge. They both attended a conference in early May on carbon farming and how to maximize carbon in our soil and draw it from our atmosphere back into the soil and tackle the issues of high nutritional soil, high-density soil nutrition and climate change at the same time. So that will be happening in just about 10 minutes when they call in to talk to us. And maybe they're checking in with Bill at this very moment by cell phone. But anyway, Guy, here we are.
Yes, sir.
Once again.
And you want to know what's happening there in the small farm up there at Guy's Eco Garden, right?
I absolutely do. And yes, sir. I know the headline for today is strawberries. But
well, we're just barely into the strawberry season. I mean, this is the first day Becky and I were able to pick enough so that she made strawberry scones, which, of course, you have enjoyed. And they are vegan, organic, and gluten-free. Now, you know, that's quite a combination, and they're still pretty darn good. But beyond that, I got to tell you that the kale, last year's kale, which is now in blossom, is really providing us great kale. That's amazing. This year's kale, which we have under a row cover because of the flea beetles, but you know, amazingly, the flea beetles do not even touch last year's kale, which is giving us great production. It really is, even though it's all in blossom. I didn't think when it would blossom that the leaves would continue to grow. But the kale with a broad leaf, like Judy's kale, like Beattie's Camden kale, and Delaware kale, all are really great broad leaf kales, as opposed to Lacinato, which is, of course, a very thin, what we call dinosaur kale. Right. But beyond that, we have some great rhubarb, too. And you didn't even try the rhubarb yet today. We've got some rhubarb sauce that Becky made and I have down here. But beyond that, the asparagus is still going famously. And but, you know, beyond that, the garlic has been hoed out. And we're just anticipating the scapes, which I figure within 2 weeks we're going to see some good garlic scapes. The Colorado potato beetles are in action, although they've been slowed down by that cool, rainy weather we've had recently. But so we've had to continually patrol for those Colorado potato bugs. But we'll patrol and we will.
And tell us, Guy, just is that a manual proposition?
It is for us.
One bug at a time?
Pretty much one bug at a time. But some of the ladies have a little bit of difficulty in squeezing the bugs. But so we give them something that they can push the bug off into, which is water. At one time we used kerosene, but that's not a smart move because you shouldn't be
kerosene in the garden.
Right. Yes, exactly. So we just give them a little a bucket of water, and so they push the bugs off into the bucket of water. Once they hit the water, they don't come out because they can't fly out of it.
And
anyway,
it's amazing how effective that if you start from the beginning of the season and keep your eye out, get the first free one out of there, then you can really...
Well, everybody should know, if you got potatoes, a Colorado potato beetle will also get on potatoes, in fact, any of the solanaceous crops.
Eggplant and...
Eggplant and even peppers, right. Anyway, the Colorado potato bug, what you look for, the female, which gets on the top of the plant and emits a hormone, which excites the boy Colorado potato beetles who climb up there, and then they get together, and the first thing you know, then the little girl Colorado potato beetle starts laying their eggs on the underside where you can't see them, the leaves, and they lay these little yellow orange egg sacks, usually of groups of about 10 to 15, and they'll hatch out in warm weather in about 3 days.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but in cold weather, sometimes they won't hatch out at all, but they'll usually be there. And once they hatch out, they really start chowing down. They'll take a potato plant and get that thing in a period of a day. If there's enough of them, they'll just have it devastated. Yeah. Anyway, so there you are.
So Guy, actually, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Do you have me on mic, Rich? I can't hear myself.
Yeah,
you're good. Okay. You're good.
Loud and clear.
So my question is, do they also attack bean plants?
I have not seen them on bean plants. However, bean plants have plenty of other animals which go after them. Absolutely.
I remember one year I must have had like 20 bean plants, and this, I don't know if it was a beetle or what, but... Like
it is a beetle,
a bright orange something.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I noticed in a certain form, if you touched them, they were sharp. They'd hurt your fingers. I don't know...
Well, it depends upon what stage.
It might have been living in between.
I don't ever remember any of them being hurt.
But all I know is these things like devastated.
Soft yellow things.
Yeah, soft yellow. That's what my experience.
But they do have hairs coming out, so maybe in the right.
Maybe in like the in between the like the worm and the adult form. But they devastated my beans. They just ate them. Given an opportunity,
they'll just jump right in there. Absolutely. Yeah. As are all sorts of creatures just sitting at the ready to attack us in every respect. Yep. But you know, we've had more rain than we need, Richard. I think we've got to have no possibility of any drought situations, even though I think 2 weeks ago somebody said we still had some sort of a drought. I can't believe that. Can you, Bill?
No.
I think it was worse north of us, in the northwestern part of Connecticut. Okay. And I haven't seen recent figures on that.
I suspect because, just last night we had two thunderstorms came through. And I told the troops, you can't go out in that field today because there's a lot of standing water in the darn field. And I don't want to have them up to their ankles in mud. plus, things won't grow in the mud. They got to have a fairly dry soil to grow and to transplant.
So they have oxygen.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the roots.
And, that's interesting. That's an interesting thing because so many of my customers say things aren't growing. And I say, well, what kind of watering do you use? Well, they keep the place wet. They water every day, whether they need it or not. Not so. You should. You just can't grow things in mud. That's not unless you're going to be rice in a rice paddy. Then you can do that. But we don't have rice, and we don't have rice paddies. Hopefully, but I guess we could start creating rice paddies with all the rain we've had. Nevertheless, the strawberries are doing famously, and so within the week we'll be in good shape on strawberries. According to Richard, we're still pretty good right now on strawberries.
Those were they weren't quite ripe, but they were just just about to hit the summit. Yeah,
With all that rain, I was really surprised that the flavor maintained because usually. With all that rain, we've got a dilution of flavor that is identifiable, absolutely. And that's regardless of whether it's corn, beans, whatever is growing. But asparagus really socks it up until you don't have to worry about the asparagus, which is still good. And the rhubarb is magnificent this year. Absolutely. The biggest rhubarb I've seen, and it's only a second year rhubarb. That is really good. And so I even brought down, but Richard didn't have a chance to try it yet, some rhubarb sauce, which I've got, which is not overly sweet because we used honey to sweeten it.
Nice.
There's no sugars in it, right?
Very nice.
Yeah.
And you have that with you today?
I do. Okay. I do. And so we have spoons to go along with it, too. Right.
So, Guy, I have a question for you. I have sage from last year that overwintered. And it's flowering now, so should I be concerned about that? It's like I'm getting, seed pods.
I wouldn't worry.
We have our guest.
Okay, we have our guest.
I'm quite sure we do. Let us check in and see if Julie Rawson and Jack Kittredge are with us. Hello.
Yeah.
Julie.
Yeah, we are indeed.
And Jack.
Good.
Great. All right, we need you to step real close to your little cell phone. We are actually... doing some advanced technology here. They're on one cell phone line, on speakerphone, if I'm not mistaken. So thank you so much for sticking with us, giving us another shot here on the Organic Farm Stand. Last couple of weeks ago, we tried, and we had a systems failure here. But you're hanging in there, and that's great. So our topic for today is carbon farming and a conference you attended between May 3rd and May 5th in Paris. Why don't you tell us, give us a little tutorial here on the whole topic, and as you tell us about what kind of exciting programming unfolded there in Paris? And not and Matt, you can also tell us about some great meals you had too. You with us?
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how to use this cell phone as a microphone.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me pretty
well? It's working really well, Jack.
It's working good.
Good, okay. The basic idea is a fairly simple one. As everybody pretty much knows who's read about climate change and global warming and so forth, the greenhouse effect, which is what they call it, is caused by a number of gases which trap heat, and carbon dioxide is a primary one. There's also methane and nitrous oxide and a few others. And because of civilization and things that we're doing, we are emitting more of those gases than we used to. And as a result, they are trapping heat. Heat is not leaving the planet as well as it used to. And if you have read very much about Venus had the same sort of problem, and it got into a runaway overheating, and life is, as we know it, is pretty much impossible on Venus. I think its temperatures there are somewhere 600 to 800 degrees now on the surface, and that's enough to boil water and so forth, and you just can't maintain life at that level. And the potential is, if we don't continue, if we don't somehow stop emitting these greenhouse gases, that we are going to overheat here as well, and make life very difficult, if not totally untenable. that's the downside. But recently, more and more interest has gone into the fact that we can, in fact, there are some things that we can do about this besides. We certainly need to radically reduce our use of fossil fuels. That's the primary reason that carbon dioxide is increasing, is because our power plants and our cars and all those things emit as a waste product carbon dioxide from burning coal, oil, gasoline, so forth. But we still need to reduce that. We need to go into more forms of energy which do not use fossil fuels. But we also find that science is supporting that we can sequester, that is, bury, essentially, a lot of carbon in the soil. After all, the soil is where that carbon originally came from. In that case, it was in the form of coal or oil, petroleum, natural gas, which are all very carbon-rich substances. And those came out of the soil, ultimately out of wells and mines and so forth, got burned, emitted that carbon into the atmosphere. And that carbon can be trapped back in the soil. And there are people who have devised very big and expensive and highly technological methods to do that. But in fact, the simplest and the easiest and the cheapest way is happening all around us every day, and that is called photosynthesis. It's what we all learned about in grade school or high school, the process by which plants, through the substance they have in them called chlorophyll, are able to use the energy of the sun to break down water and carbon dioxide that they get from the air into the constituent parts, which are hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon, and then recombine those so that out of those that combination, they have made carbohydrates, which is essentially food for themselves, and pure oxygen, which they release, and that's how we get oxygen back into the atmosphere. And something like 15% of all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is cycled through plants by photosynthesis every year. So this is a huge pump, engine, whatever you want to call it, that is cycling a lot of that carbon dioxide back into the soil. And the question is, how can we keep it in the soil? If we don't find a method to keep it in the soil, it's going to be cycling right out again, and it's not going to solve the problem. And so a lot of energy has gone, and science and research and so forth has gone into the question of how can we sequester that carbon, that is, bury it in a way that will be stable and long-lasting and not come out of the soil again. So that was the basic idea that has animated the people who came to this conference. And that idea has been, I think, was originally proposed, a generation ago or more in scientific papers before climate change became such a pressing issue before overheating happens so much, and we have these weather extremes now, and now people are much more interested in finding a solution. And so this carbon sequestration issue or potential has become very a very hot topic, and that's what this conference was all about. And we got there were about 180 people there who were from all around the globe, largely from Europe and North America and Australia, but also we had probably 15% of them came from the third world, Africa, Asia, Latin America. So there was a good representation of small farmers and people who come from what they call the global south as opposed to the global north, which is pretty much the English-speaking, Europe and America. And the people there were scientists, were nonprofit representatives, were people from governmental agencies, not a whole lot of them, probably about 5% were from government agencies, from the press, writers, and so forth. A lot of funders, people who represent foundations. So there was a wide variety of people there. And we spent 3 days basically trying to understand this issue, come to an understanding of what the best science was, look at the various aspects of what practices are good for sequestering carbon and building it in a stable form in soil, what soil management practices, be they farming or be they other kinds of land management work, and to then think about what sorts of programs, either government policies that have taxes and incentives attached, maybe, or maybe just nonprofit educational work that could urge people to adopt these programs, whatever. What sort of programs would be effective at what kind of a scale they would have to be implemented to make this happen worldwide? Because to really deal with this climate issue, we would have to have large scale participation all around the globe. So that's hopefully maybe a initial setting. Are there any
Can I just maybe clarify a couple of things for our listeners?
Sure,
the general trend on this planet for billions of years has been to take carbon out of the atmosphere through plants, and that's where the coal and the oil and the natural gas came from, or much of it. But then also plants are always pumping some of the carbon they take out of the atmosphere as those carbohydrates into the soil, which is then feeding the soil organisms, which is where a lot of that carbon is. And then eventually, if it works well, if we're doing it well, it becomes stable humus. But what we've done, so a lot of the carbon not only comes from fossil fuels, but comes from our bad agricultural practices, using a lot of tillage, using a lot of monocultures, using a lot of chemical fertilizers and herbicides, which damage the life in the soil, so what I think Christine Jones calls the liquid carbon pathway, going through the plants, out to the roots, into the soil organisms, and hopefully stabilized in the soil, hasn't been working, so that we've put a lot of the carbon right out of the soil into the atmosphere. So we're really reversing something very bad we've done in this attempt that we're talking about.
Yes, that's very accurate. That's all very true, and that's where a lot of the research is going on now, to understand exactly what the process is by which that liquid carbon is emitted by the plant roots in such quantities into the soil, how that's treated by the organisms in the soil. But it seems from what we are learning in the science that in fact those microorganisms, the fungi, the bacteria, all the little tiny organisms in the soil are the crucial component of creating some kind of a stable carbon mass, be it humus or something else. Yes, seems like that's what's happening.
Yes, which is why the biodiversity in the soil is so important, and organic techniques which minimize tillage and minimize biocides are so critical to this strategy.
Jack,
yeah, I think that's true.
Jack and Julie, we have heard in the last day or two that the 45th president, who shall go nameless on this program, is poised to withdraw the United States from the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. What is your thought on that? And did that climate accord address any of these issues that you're talking about today? Did it actually get into the down into the humus, I guess? And you know, is this summit that just happened on May 3rd through 5th, is this sort of filling in the gaps that might have been not discussed or addressed at the Paris Climate Accord in 2015?
Well, the official Paris Climate Accord was something reached by the governments around the world, and it did not deal with this whole issue of carbon sequestration. It dealt with emissions, which has been and is recognizably, you know, the major source of the problem that we are emitting, you know, through our burning of fossil fuels and so forth. And this aspect of it, which is the carbon sequestration and the mitigation possibilities that are possible when you rebury carbon in the soil through this process, was brought up at the Paris conference, but was never adopted as part of the program or anything. So what it seems like Trump is likely to withdraw from is the program that put together sort of quotas and numbers for different governments for how much they were going to reduce their emissions to try to get us down to no more than a 2 degree Celsius, or hopefully even a 1.5 degree Celsius increase in temperatures. So directly, that's a slam at the environmental movement and the climate change movement. But it's really nothing. Does not take away from this process at all that we're talking about, which is something that is being supported by only some of the governments that were involved in Paris. So the United States government is not one. The French government is the primary one that has bought on to this process. Most of the other major European nations have not yet done that at a governmental level. So it's sort of emerging at a non-governmental organization level right now. And through the science and the funders and the NGOs are the ones who are looking at it. And also, I must say, at state governments, there were several representatives of state governments at the conference in Paris, one of whom, Dana Stein, is a legislator in Maryland, and he just got a bill passed and signed by the governor that is similar to what we are filing here in Massachusetts, and California has passed, and Vermont has filed, and Connecticut has filed. And I think there's a groundswell, because the federal administration is not doing this, that state administrators and legislators are now getting involved and trying to pass and implement healthy soils programs at a state level. Most of these do not have incentives, financial incentives and so forth yet, but they're setting up systems by which soil can be monitored, evaluated. The processes by which carbon can be sequestered are going to be looked at. And I think the potential is there that states can move into this realm, just like I guess Governor Brown in California just recently announced he was going to do that regardless of whatever Trump did.
Yeah, I think it would be great to hear some of the details about what those programs might entail at the state level, how they would be implemented, but also what commercial farmers, how they would have to comply, and would this be like a fight at the ground level of, oh, you're gonna be cutting into our profits. These kinds of issues, I'm not sure if you dealt with those in Paris, but that is something.
Well, I think realistically, we are not to that level yet. Mm-hmm. What's being passed is sort of, shell programs that set up, say, a state office of soil quality, perhaps. And it's set up within a state bureaucracy, and some definitions are established and so forth. But the real guts of it, that is, what money is going to be available, what kind of, teeth, carrots and sticks are going to be used, has not been developed yet. And that is the kind of thing that once these offices are set up, that I think nonprofits and scientists and policy people will thrash those kind of decisions out. And there'll probably be boards set up to actually implement them and set standards and so forth, but that will be where the real work is going to happen over the next year or two, I think.
let me just point out to make sure people understand that this process of good agricultural practices, which let the which encourage the maximum amount of carbon to go into the soil and to remain in the soil, not only are very good for the climate, but they're very good for the health of the soil, very good for the way agricultural lands or any lands respond to the kind of deluges and droughts that are more common with climate change. So we're really making things better, adapting to the new situation while we're mitigating and hopefully, if we're doing it right, pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and reversing some of the damage we've done.
Yeah, I can speak to that, Bill.
Good.
I think that's the exciting part about all this, that it's only about best agricultural practices, and what we really need to do is to figure out how to get on board with those. And so there's a lot of good work that's been done by the Savory Institute and people who are in that grazing world, who have really shown on millions of acres, really, that appropriate grazing of animals can really build soil structure and also bring back desertified areas. Alan Savory has shown that over and over in Africa and other places around the world. And it's a very simple process of with grazing that you have the animals on there for a very short period of time, and then you move them off, and they don't come back again to that spot until it's grown up again. And the mechanism that happens there is that when grass is chewed off or mowed off or however taken down, it has a root structure that is about the same size as the above ground parts. So the grass will slough off a lot of its root system, and that can become that stabilized carbon, especially if an animal comes through and not only eats but also defecates and urinates on that, so there's this constant fertility going on too, and their hoof action will get all that built into the soil, so you have a rush of feed for the microbial life. They'll go back about at the same time that the roots are sloughing off to match what's on top. There's a whole new process of regrowth and up above and below. And these methods have, you know, just proven over and over again to work extremely well for grazing animals, wherever you are. So, you know, that's something that's pretty well proven. What we struggle with in NOFA, I think NOFA Mass particularly, is trying to help folks come up with really good ways to raise those annual vegetable crops, which a lot of our certified farmers and really not certified either, but just the sustainable farmers are doing a lot of vegetable production. And as you say, they're using a lot of tillage, a lot of black plastic. You know, it's pretty ugly out there. I drive by a certified organic farm every day to pick up one of our staff members, and all you see is bare dirt and black plastic. And so if we want to think about the principles of how we support photosynthesis and how we support the mycorrhizal fungi, which I feel are the real key actors in this, they are the internet, the networkers in the soil, and they function really well when you have sod or when you have a lot of roots growing all the time. And so that's what we want to do, is to think about ways to have as much green growth going as long as the year as possible. And one of the no-nos really for organic farmers is to really reduce or quit tilling altogether. And I have to say, on our farm, we've been here 35 years. We've been tilling for 32 or 33 of them, and we're have really moved away from that. And now we're really struggling with how you do that soil prep effectively to get ready for your new crops to come in. But our very limited results of, you know, 2 or 3 years with this is that we do have, this year, for example, someone just told me that there are a couple of CSAs that aren't going to start next week because their soils are too wet. And, you know, we certainly have had rain or clouds or both pretty much every day, it seems like, for the last 2 months. And we don't have any problems with that water because our soil water holding capacity is really enhanced in this system. When you till, you oxidize You destroy the soil aggregation. You get a lot of oxygen and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. The soil collapses and can't really percolate water down into it. The opposite is true, that when it's dry, it just turns hard as a brick or hard as sand, whatever it is, and, you know, becomes very, the roots can't penetrate properly. So it's really about changing some of those practices and thinking about that green as much as possible, as long as possible into the year, using perhaps green strips and having those, you know, alive all the time. And you suggested the whole biodiversity thing, too, because it's really important for the more different kinds of plants you have growing in any particular place, the more different kinds of soil microorganisms you're going to have below ground. So you have biodiversity above, biodiversity below. And the more you have the biodiversity, the more you have access to minerals for mineralization for the plants to use, etc. So it's just a compounding, positively compounding system. And above ground, of course, if you have biodiversity, you have a lot of different kinds of native pollinators. You'll have more birds. You'll have more, you know, toads and frogs and all the other wildlife that come. One of the things that we've super noticed on our farm is that we have such a massive worm population now that we never had before. You know, we did all the right things with organic growing, except for the fact that we were tilling. Mm. And I just have noticed this huge upswing in worms, and they are really the livestock of the soil. They're the ones who will rototill. They do that all day long, but they do it in appropriate technology, I guess. They're much more appropriate technology than a machine.
We're speaking with Julie Rawson, Executive Director of Mass NOFA, and Jack Kitteridge, who is the Soil Carbon Program Coordinator at Mass NOFA, and they have beginning of May, they went to a conference in Paris on carbon farming and sequestration of carbon in the soil. And this is a fascinating conversation. I got to say, you guys are breaking it down to the level where I can understand it, and if that's happening, that is good teaching, because I don't know. There's something missing in my prefrontal cortex. I don't usually process this stuff very, very quickly. But it's going in, and I hope it stays. I have one question, and I'm going to pass it on to others here. Do some species in the cover crops or any of the things that you're growing, do some species sequester carbon better than others? I mean, is anything green going to do that, or are some better than others?
Certainly the grasses are highly renowned for their ability to put on, basically anything that puts on a heavy-duty root system is going to do more carbon sequestration. The more roots, the more mycorrhizal fungi, the more opportunities for carbon sequestration to happen. But everything does it. And I don't think it's ever an issue of, well, people will say, oh, we have to go to, you know, agroforestry because that's the best way to go, or we have to do grazing because of this, or, you know, it's all about having a biodiverse system. And I think Bill mentioned that monocropping. That's a real no-no if you really want to have a vibrant system. You want to have as many different things going on as possible. So, yeah, grasses are great for root systems, but legumes are really great for nitrogen fixation. And the brassica family, which have daikon and broccoli and rob and all those things, they're very good for cleansing the soil. So, you know, every bring in the forbs, they're called, you know, sunflowers, buckwheat, things like that, they are very good at attracting beneficial insects. So they all have a real value in the system, and they all bring something to the whole. It's a real family affair. It's not like one thing will ever be the best way to go.
There are people who are champions of various kinds of photosynthesizing, I guess you might say. There are actually two different pathways, photosynthetic pathways. One is more active when it's very hot, and actually is more efficient at photosynthesizing carbon, but it only works when it's hot, it's very hot, and the other one comes into play when it's cooler. And there are various kinds, like Julie was mentioning, there's, you know, trees and grasses and forbs and different kinds of things. I think the lesson for us to take away is that biodiversity is the key, because in any one day in New England, you can have, you know, some hot, some cold, some dry, some wet, and in all the different things are going to come into their best situation sometime, and you want to have anything available to maximize that photosynthesis when it's appropriate. So if you got stuff that can do it when it's wet and other stuff that can do it when it's dry, you'll be all set.
So Jack or Julie, I just have a question, and I probably should know this since this is an organic farming show, but when you talk about no-till, what is, like, tilling involve? Is it involve going to a certain depth with mechanical plows? In other words, how deep is bad, I'll call it bad tillage?
Well, tillage is what a tiller does is it you know, it's on a wheel that goes around and around in circles, and so it really stirs, kind of rips up the soil and stirs it and drops it again in place. And the reason that again, if we think about the mycorrhizal fungi as the folks that we want to most support in this effort, that is the most destructive of all of any kind of behavior when you're impacting the soil. Because if you think about them being on a little grid, let's just think about a piece of cheesecloth or a piece of woven wire that's a quarter inch squares or whatever, and you come through there and you hack that all up, you know, it takes a long time for those networks to grow back together again. So we're constantly fighting their natural system, and they are the ones who bring a lot of resources, not only to the roots, but also to the a lot of the other biology that's in the soil. So they're really the connectors. They're the collagen or whatever in the system. So I thought, let's say back 5-6 years ago, okay, we had this nice 4-foot tractor mounted tiller, and we do about 3 acres of vegetables. So we would make a bed with that, and then we'd say, okay, we're only going to till 2 inches deep, which we did for a few years. But I always found that I was just barely staying even by, you know, using foliar applications once a week and drenching the soil and using organic amendments, et cetera, barely staying even, if that, in terms of fertility and soil organic matter. And like I said, there weren't any worms around. So my experience of going cold turkey, selling the rototiller, and trying to figure out how to do that with winter kill cover crops, with mulching with things like wood chips and hay and leaves, and, you know, just pulling that aside in the springtime, with using some of these, we're in our period of dealing with our rye and our vetch, and we've been trying to solarize the soil, which is, you put clear plastic on, and it will, in a day's time, it'll kind of burn the grass, but and kind of kill that plant, but it does it in a very quick fashion so that you can come in and prepare the soil. Well, last week we had the plastic on for 8 days, took it off, and it was like, there's no difference. So, you know, that technique is not working this spring, because today we had, what, maybe 4 hours of sunshine, and that was a lot today. So, you know, those methods are stuff that we're working with, and we're, at this point, you know, using hose and trying to scrape some of that greenery off. And we're also, a little later, when our rye will head up and before it goes to seed, we can come in and mow that or crush it and then plant through it. But right now we are in this period where we have a lot of these wintering over cover crops are still quite green. So those are all, you know, techniques that we're struggling with. You know, what's the best methodology to go from a you know, to go move into no-till and for planting vegetables? A lot of different options. You know, using animals, we bring our animals in the wintertime and graze that, and you can kill some of that grass, you know, some of those, that greenery with them. You know, still working out a lot of that. A lot of people use cardboard in smaller systems, so that really brings earthworms like crazy. a lot of things to consider.
So the idea is to keep the ground covered the maximum amount of time, and just remove the covering at when you're planting, and then also not just sort of clearing a field, just removing the ground cover in the spots where you want the seeds or sprouts to go in. Am I on the right track here?
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of the bigger plants, like tomatoes or peppers or squash or something, you can maybe dig a hole, and you might have some residue of grass or rye or something around that you can mulch out, or the plants will grow over that and kill that when you're dealing with small seed crops like carrots and, you know, beets and turnips and radishes and things like that. You have to be a little more creative. And so, you know, trying to do the best of all possible worlds. You can't always have everything all green. If you're going to have winter kill cover crops, at some point they're going to die. But hopefully if you have, for example, permanent green pathways, which we're working with, we have 48 inch beds and 20 inch green pathways that we just hand mow when they grow up. But if those are alive all winter long, that's going to be a place for that mycorrhizal fungi to stay alive in the wintertime. Because the other thing is that mycorrhizal fungi will die if there's nothing for them to eat. If they are, they'll go dormant and do some amount of work in the wintertime if they're under a grass area or in a tree or whatever, you know, living root essentially. So we want to, you know, trying to meet the needs of agriculture at the same time we're meeting the needs of the soil microorganisms is really what it's all about. Understanding those systems better and then, you know, doing the compromising where we feel we have to in order to raise food is part of the whole exciting part process forward, yeah. I think. Very exciting to innovate and try to come up with new methods. And the other thing I wanted to say, last year we were in a drought in Central Mass. And first of all, our hay/pasture field never went brown last year because of the way we've been managing our cows and our chickens. But secondarily, our crop quality was so much far superior than it had ever been before. Our CSA members, you know, new ones and old ones alike, was like, wow, this is just the best food available. And they, you know, they continue to pump out really good crops throughout this, you know, modest for the world standards, but severe for Massachusetts standards drought that we had last year.
How do you explain that? I mean,
it's the soil. It's the healthy soil which does that.
Okay, so the soil, in spite of the fact that the surface was dusty and dry, the actual soil nutrition was at a level where it was supporting. And could you talk a little bit about the what happens to food quality with this carbon sequestration? I mean, we understand you're building up, you're drawing carbon from the atmosphere, which is a good thing. How does that affect nutritional density of the food itself?
I'm going to talk a little bit about mineralization, and I think Jack will talk something about this too, but I think part of the deal with the food quality is the quantity and quality of the minerals that are in the food. So again, Christine Jones says it always so eloquently, that each plant has a suite of microbial partners that it works with. And so if you have a broccoli plant in your ground, and then around that you have undersown clover, for example, which is what we do. All of our brassica plants, once they get to be a certain height of about 9 inches or so, we undersow that whole bed with a crimson clover. And so then we're having this nitrogen feeding going on all the time. The whole brassica family really likes their nitrogen served up to them, and legumes will process and what's the word they do to nitrogen?
Six
nitrogen into the system. But not only is that happening, you're also getting more photosynthesis, so you're getting more mineralization happening. The more photosynthesis you have, the more bacteria you have active underground mineralizing what's there and making it available to the plants. So it all feeds back up into the plant. This is basically, it's a takeout system, or one of the soil consultants we work with said it's like they're calling out, the plant will say, okay, I need this, I need that, and they send a little carbon down or a little sugar. Basically, they're, you know, when you think about it, you anthropomorphize it. They photosynthesize. They shoot sugar, carbon, into the soil and say, here, this is what I want. And then the microbes run around and scurry around and get it back to them because they've just been there's been a nice payoff that they've gotten. So I just want to say, I think Jack wanted to say something else about food quality.
Well, there's been a lot of research and thought about food quality sort of on the alternative edge of the organic movement, and we've been involved in a good deal of that. And there's some theories out there that have not yet been are not yet hard science, but I think make a lot of sense and bear out in what we see and how plants grow. And they basically say that, you know, you can have a plant that is growing, that is alive, and is photosynthesizing and is making carbohydrates, but it's struggling. It's not doing well. It's not thriving. And that's usually because it does not have a healthy soil. It does not have a highly, you know, carbonaceous soil. It does not have a lot of soil life in there. And that plant is not going to be doing much besides making enough carbohydrates for it to survive and to process what it needs to do for life. But if you begin to build up that soil, that plant can reach some of its further potential. It's kind of like, you know, a person who's sick. You know, if you're not living up to your full potential and you're sick, you can't really do a lot of the things that that you could do if you were, you know, healthy. And that's the same thing with plants. A plant will be able to produce more proteins if it, in fact, comes from a healthier soil. And those more proteins are going to enable it. Not only is it going to be a better, you know, food for us, but it's also going to enable that plant to resist certain amounts of disease and to have a better resistance to predation and so forth. And again, if you follow that pathway and you increase the soil and get even better, the next step seems to be that plants can produce, you know, oils, lipids, the kinds of things that make a harder surface, a firmer surface, a thicker surface for the leaves and so forth for the plant, that can produce the kinds of surfaces that are harder for insects to penetrate and so forth. And so the plant, just like we as humans or animals have evolved an immune system over time that has protected us from the kinds of attacks from disease and so forth that are in part of nature, so the plants have also been evolving, and they've been evolving and using the resources that are available to them to continue to fight the predation and the disease organisms and so forth. And when you get to the top, you know, the plants at that stage, you know, if they have a fully healthy soil, can produce the kinds of flavors and aromas and they call them, you know, phytochemicals, basically hundreds and thousands of things that plants produce as repellents, as attractants. Plants are chemical factories, and when they're healthy, they can do an amazing job of producing stuff. And a lot of these are the things that give flavor and nutritional value to plants. So when you buy a lettuce or a broccoli or an apple or something like that, you know, there's a huge range of nutritional quality that you can get depending on how well that plant has been grown. And oftentimes people who are experienced can tell by taste, by aroma, by, you know, color, by feel, whether that apple or that broccoli is in fact, well, you know, healthily grown in good soil. But there's a lot of research on trying to get, you know, get those, get more data on this issue. But that's the theory, is that you know, I think it makes a lot of sense to me that if you have a healthy soil, your plants are going to resist disease and be better for you. Yes.
We've got 1 minute, I'm told, and I wanted to let our audience know for 3 decades or more, Jack's been editing the Natural Farmer magazine of NOFA. And if you go to thenaturalfarmer.org, you can get see many of the issues. And the last winter's issue is on carbon, climate, and soil biology. So it's an opportunity for our listeners to follow up on this by going online to thenaturalfarmer.org. But it's been wonderful to talk to you. It seems like we could just keep going with this for a while.
Yeah,
this, but we can't because they cut off.
Yeah, we're out of time.
We are out of time, but no, thank you guys so much for coming back. And it is well worth the Sturm und Drang to get you here. And even on a cell phone hookup and over our little Dixie Cup phone system here, the truth came through and the information is invaluable. Thank you so much, Julie Rawson and Jack Kittredge from Mass
Richard,
NOFA.
Can I just give you one more URL?
Yes.
NOFAMass.org/carbon, and that's where we have all of our carbon resources all cataloged in one place. So NOFAMASS.org/carbon. That's a wealth of resources there.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks a lot for all the information.
Take care, and we'll talk to you all soon. Bye bye. Okay, great.
Okay.
And this is the Organic Farm Stand. We will be back in 2 weeks. Chris Ferriero, Guy Beardsley, Bill Dusing, myself, Richard Hill. Thank you so much for listening.
Organic love, 100% natural, baby. Organic love, 100% natural. This world we live in.
Programming support comes from New Morning Market, the independently owned organic market whose mission since 1971 has been to build a local, healthy, and sustainable food community. Offering local organic produce and humanely raised meats, sustainably harvested seafood, and prepared-to-order organic juices, smoothies, and meals to dine in or take out. Located at 129 Main Street North in Woodbury, Connecticut. More information at newmorn.com. Good food, good people, good life. New Morning Market. Support for WPKN provided by College Street Music Hall in downtown New Haven, bringing folk acts City in Color with Noah Gunderson on June 9th, Trombone Shorty and Orleans Avenue with New Breed Brass Band on June 11th, Horn-Driven Soul Band St. Paul and the Broken Bones with Shovels and Rope on June 18th, and then the genre mixing Michael Franti and Spearhead on June 27th. More information at collegestreetmusichall.com.
It's that time again. WPKN's 6th annual Got Bluegrass benefit concert at the Acoustic to help raise money for our new transmitter. Get your summer started on Wednesday, June 7th with some roots, alt country, and bluegrass music from three Connecticut-based bands, including the Grey Light Campfire, Hitch and the Giddy Up, and the Wool Hat String Band. We'll also be joined by special guests, Lisa Furman. The Acoustic is located on Fairfield Ave in the Black Rock section of Bridgeport. Doors open at 7 p.m. and music starts at 7:30. Tickets at the door cost $15. WPKN is looking for individuals and small businesses interested in helping sponsor this event to help with the transmitter replacement project. Call the WPKN office if interested. We'll see you Wednesday, June 7th at the Acoustic for the baddest Got Bluegrass yet.
This is Caroline Doctorow, and I hope that you'll join me this Saturday night at 7 p.m. for Song Trails, a celebration of folk and roots music with well-known artists and others that are a bit below the radar. So that's Song Trails with me, your host, Caroline Doctorow, here on WPKN 89.5 on your FM dial and streaming live at WPKN.org.
The New Pond Education Center in Reading, Connecticut is holding its biennial Invitational Art Show featuring original paintings, drawings, and sculptures by 50 professional artists from June 3rd to June 11th. Art galleries in the Farms Learning Center will be open daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. and admission is free. All proceeds will benefit the center's educational programming. More info at newpondfarm.org.
Hello, this is Vince Santilli, CEO of Homes for the Brave. We're a nonprofit organization established right here in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 2002, and our mission is to provide transitional housing, case management, and vocational services to homeless men and women, primarily veterans. To date, we have helped more than 1,050 men and women get back on their feet, and our success stories are incredible. We have three facilities, including the first and only house exclusively for female veterans and their children in Connecticut. Our amazing team at Homes for the Brave can use your help in so many different ways, whether it be supporting us financially, holding a collection for items on our wish list, volunteering, or participating in one of our fun special events. To learn more about how you can help us